Silver Apples, live in London. One of the founders of that group is here as our guest on this evening's Flipside, a man known as Simeon. Simeon, thanks for coming and visiting us here back in your old hometown of Knoxville.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here.
You weren't in Knoxville very, very long, were you?
About 7 years.
Yeah. Do you remember anything from it?
Sure. I remember walking to Belmorris Elementary School. And I went to kindergarten at the little place next door to it. I don't remember the name of that. I remember playing with kids in the neighborhood. I remember sliding on sleds down the street in the snow. Yeah, I camping out in my backyard in a tent. I thought I was in the Army. Yeah, I have small memories of Knoxville.
Do you remember what street you lived on or what neighborhood?
My mama sat me down when I was like 2 years old and said, "Now you have to remember how to say this. When you get lost, say, 'Mr. Police Officer, my name is Simeon Cox. I live at 1709 North Hills Boulevard, Knoxville, Tennessee.'" And then I would bow. And so I have never had that out of my mind. That's stuck.
I live on Kenilworth Lane, which is about a half a block from there.
Okay. Well, we probably have relatives.
What year did you leave Knoxville? Do you remember what year it was?
That would have been, let's see. I was born in 1938, so that would have been somewhere around 45 or 46 or in there. Something like that.
And you headed down to New Orleans? Is that where you went next, or the Gulf Coast?
My dad got a job when he got out of the Army. He got a job in New Orleans. He had been working with the TVA, and then the war came along, and he got a job with some New Orleans outfit that was building the airport down there. And so he went to work for them and brought the family down there. And so I grew up in New Orleans, basically.
You must have heard some incredible music at that time in music history and in that place.
I used to tell my mom and dad I was going to the local dance and catch the 7-cent trolley to Rampart Street and walk down into the Bywater and catch people like Fats Domino, Big Mama Thornton, people like that who were just playing bars on Rampart Street. And I would be like 12 to 15 years old, the only white kid in the place, and the only kid, period. But and I never had a drink or anything, but I would just stand there and listen to the music. And I think the people got used to seeing me, and they got just used to having me there because nobody ever gave me any trouble. But I had real solid musical roots, not in New Orleans jazz kind of stuff. I've never really thought much of that. I always thought it was sort of like commercial tourist jazz. But the stuff that was going on in the clubs on Rampart Street was the real nitty-gritty of music today, I believe.
When did you start creating music, and did this New Orleans experience accelerate that?
Probably accelerated it some. I ran away from New Orleans at about the age of 19 or so to become a famous artist. I was going to be a famous painter in New York. And I just found that after butting my head against the wall up there for a few years that it was just harder than it sounded. I mean, it's not like I was totally unsuccessful. I had a small show and a gallery up there, and I had a couple of pieces picked up by the Museum of Modern Art, but really couldn't make a living. So I was doing what a lot of artists were doing, and that is just sitting in with musicians, bands that would come through the Greenwich Village coffee house scene. and playing tambourine, singing backup, that kind of stuff. And after experiencing some bands up in Connecticut, I worked as a dishwasher, and a bunch of the musicians there were musicians. A bunch of the dishwashers were musicians. I kind of got more into that than to painting. It was more fun, more alive, making a little money, traveling some nice places, and so I just kind of bagged art for a while.
Did you ever cross paths with, say, the Fugs or the Mothers of Invention?
Oh, God, yeah, yeah. Lived in the same hotel with the Mothers of Invention for about a month. Boy, what a motley crew that is. They were an amazing bunch of people. I remember the drummer, who was this big, tall Indian guy, had a woman that was his, I guess, his wife. Most everybody back then was still doing the marriage thing. And he had all these papooses, all these little kids following him around. And the woman always had one strapped on her back. And it was, so there was this Indian family that was always around the Mothers of Invention. I just thought that was so bizarre.
Jimmy Carl Black.
Was that his name?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. The Indian of the group, I believe so.
Oh, man, he was a character. He would stand in the middle of the lobby and just stare. And I don't know if he was putting on an act or if that's the way he really was, but he was fabulous. I loved him. The Fugs, we played at the Fillmore with the Fugs several times. I remember one time the bass player in the Fugs, they say he OD'd on acid. I don't think you can OD on acid. It's not the kind of drug that does that. But he crawled underneath the piano and started playing Paul McCartney riffs, proclaiming he was Paul McCartney, and he refused to come out. And they eventually had to call the paramedics to come and drag him out of there and cart him off to Bellevue Mental Ward.
Where he probably rose to the office of president.
Right. He probably, yeah, he probably runs a record label right now.
Yeah, I would believe that. So when you formed your first band, it started out more as a traditional rock band, right? You didn't have the electronics.
We were a total just cover band. We didn't even hardly have any original material. I would write a lot of original material, and we would do it here and there, but most people in the clubs that we played said, yeah, I'll play more Rolling Stones or something. So we'd do that. It was a cover band called The Random Concept, and we lived at the Albert Hotel along with every other band that came through New York, seemed like.
At what point did it just get distilled down to two people, and why?
Well, after the Random Concept broke up, the booking agent who was working with us, he liked me, the singer. All I was doing was singing. I didn't have an instrument. And he loved the drummer, and he put the drummer with the Commodores. He's a little black kid named Ronnie Bailey, great drummer. And he went and played with the Commodores for about 2 years. And he got me a job with a band called the Overland Stage Electric Band. And they were the house band at the Café Wa at the time. And he said, you know, they're a great band. You'll love working with musicians, but they can't sing. But don't tell them they can't sing. But you go in and sing with them, and I'll book you all over the place. So that's how I got a job with them, playing four or five sets a night at the Café Wa. We didn't have enough material, so they would stretch songs out. Sometimes songs would last 20 minutes. And what's a singer going to do? I'm standing there on stage with my thumbs in my pockets, trying to act interested. Well, one day I got the bright idea of bringing this oscillator up on stage that I had seen in a friend's apartment and plugging it into the PA amp. And when they went on their long, stretched out solos, I started going, wee, wah, wah, wah. And I was in heaven. I loved it. And it just kept me alive that whole night. And at the end of the night, the guys came up to me and said, you take that thing out of here and don't you ever bring it back again. And we don't want to ever see it again. And if you bring it back, you're out of the band. And just at that moment, the club owner came over and said, that's what I've been looking for. Do more of that. That's what I want. Stop all that blues stuff and all that cover stuff. Do that. And that just, of course, enraged them, and they quit, all except for the drummer, whose name was Danny Taylor. And he was sitting there saying, I thought that was pretty damn cool. Let's do that. I said, okay. So the two of us started monkeying around with ideas on how to put just the oscillators and the drums together to make music. And that was Silver Apples. That's how it was born.
Oscillation talks.
So the oscillator, in a sense, was a filter, not just for musical sounds, but for people.
Yeah. Good people filter. I have driven many people out of that room with a filter.
But then you attract other kinds.
Yeah. You weed out, you know, the ones you don't want around.
How did it become that you were able to land a record contract? I know that in the mid-60s, a lot of times the record companies didn't understand any of it, so they signed all of it.
Well, that's kind of the way it went. Our manager kept having people come around. He had a big loft where we set up our gear, and he just said, look, you can come up here and rehearse. Let's give it 6 months. Come up here and rehearse. Develop something out of this. I'll bring people up to hear you. Let's just get something going. And so he would bring up record label people or whoever he'd meet in bars, poets, stuff, and bring them up there, and they'd listen. Most of them would just run out. After about 30 minutes, they couldn't take it anymore, and they'd go. But this one guy from Cap Records kept coming back. And one day he said, I'll take a chance on it. Let's do something. And so that's how we ended up with Cap Records. Cap Records had never had any rock and roll at all. I mean, it was all like lounge stuff, piano singers, and, you know, that kind of thing. So I think they thought, well, you know, maybe we were their ticket to the new pop thing, which totally turned out to be not true. They didn't have a clue how to market us or anything. Yeah, we just kind of were this guy's idea about maybe he could make a career out of it. And then as he got into it, I think he decided that being associated with us was going to ruin his career. So he developed mononucleosis and went to the hospital and pretended he had nothing to do with us. So we had no producer, even for the first record, nothing, nobody to help us.
And despite they really didn't know what to do with it or how to market it, those first two still cracked the top 100, right?
They did, absolutely. Yeah, people bought them. There's pretty good stuff going on in there if you can get over the lack of guitars and some of my out of tune oscillators. There's actually some pretty interesting ideas. I love to play that material. I play it today. Every time I play oscillations, it's like a new time out, because I've built into it improvisational things that I do.
Well, all in all, it's their songs. You know, I mean, that people can latch on to, ultimately.
Yeah. It's not like the album was just an hour of electronic doodly, which a lot of the electronic music at the time, now that I've looked back on it and see, a lot of it was just this kind of laboratory, experimental-sounding stuff, layers of this and that. I was actually trying to make pop music with it, danceable pop music. I think that's why it's lasted.
Were you aware of like Edgar Varèse and people like that as well?
Had no idea. No. I was not educated in electronics or serious music at all. Strictly a rock and roll kid, lived in my car on the street.
Like Larry Mullins did out in L.A., the guy you're playing with at Big Ears.
Yep, that's right. He and I are street people. We speak the same language.
So you actually named your oscillator the Simeon.
No, I didn't. That was Cap Records.
Okay.
One of their promotional geniuses.
How did you tune that thing?
Turning knobs and dials, which every time a cloud passed over, if a bird lit on the building, the thing would go out of tune. It was almost impossible. You just learned to live with it.
Did you ever get booked in a place to play that had absolutely no interest in what you were doing or was totally the opposite of what they were expecting?
You mean audience-wise?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we've played in some places where people just stood there and stared. It seems to be in some areas of the country, there was a lot of acceptance of what we were doing just because it was something different. People were curious. And in other areas, it seemed threatening. I think California was probably the hardest nut to crack. They had a music scene out there that they sort of had dug their heels in with, and they felt it was theirs, and, you know, they didn't really want these New York guys coming in there and showing them anything new. Whereas people in Cincinnati or Minneapolis and a few places that we played where you wouldn't expect that there would be a good audience, there were fantastic audiences. And then we had really good response in New York, but only among certain people. There were those in New York who felt like, you know, the rock and roll, which was our new revolution, it was our new thing, it was you know, going to rule the world, and it's got to have guitars in it, man. Got to have blues progressions, man. And so there were those people, but there were others, especially in the art group, the art community, that really liked that we had broken the rules.
At what point did you realize that, hey, this is going to be too difficult to keep going or make a living at?
I never felt that way. It was a legal problem that we had that stopped us from playing. I've never felt that we couldn't make a living. I mean, we weren't getting rich or anything, but we weren't starving. We were being paid fairly good money in some places. I was amazed that people would pay that kind of money to two guys who would come in there and make a racket and for 45 minutes to an hour and a half and then leave and give us all that money.
Yeah.
That made no sense.
What, the managers and record companies couldn't hide from you, you mean?
Yeah, right. There was that, I'm sure. We never received a nickel for that record, even though it ran 10, some people say 13 weeks in the top 100 on Billboard. Cap Records always maintained that they were spending more money on promotion than they were actually making. And that may be true. It may be that to put a band on the road costs a lot of money and that you got to do payola everywhere and you got to, whatever they do, whatever the expenses are, make posters. I don't know. Maybe that is more expensive than whatever they were making on the records. But they never paid us any royalties. I get royalties now from people who picked up the pieces of Cap Records, Universal Music, MCA. I get royalties now from them. So surely back in the day there were some royalties when it was actually in the shelves and selling. But I've never seen a nickel.
And Silver Apples and you went a long period of right of not performing live or recording or doing product. What was that like, first of all, after having that experience?
I just decided, and so did Danny, that if I couldn't be a Silver Apple, I didn't want to be a musician. Both of us, after the band went, Silver Apples didn't really break up. It never really broke up. Danny and I had never a falling out or a bad word to say it to each other. It was the industry that stopped us from playing music after a while. After that happened, Danny got session work as a drummer. He was a fantastic drummer. He got session work, and he came to the conclusion that it just wasn't rewarding if it wasn't Silver Apples. He couldn't do the freedom that, and the thing that he had developed that he so loved and was so personally hooked onto. He couldn't do that with other bands. And so he just quit playing music, and exactly the same thing happened to me. Without even knowing that Danny had gone through the same thing, I did some session work as the Mr. Electronics freakout guy. And playing against some people, playing guitars and stuff, it just made no sense. I just couldn't make it work. So I stopped doing that. I became a DJ for a while, and then I split. I left New York. Went back down to Mobile, Alabama.
So you're done with music, you know, in a sense. If you can't do the Silver Apples, you're not going to do anything. Then what happened? Obviously something happened.
Selling ice cream. There's a lot of heat on the Gulf Coast. People like ice cream down there, right? And you can go out in an ice cream truck mostly any time of year and sell ice cream. So that was a good job. I was not doing too bad. And I met a guy who got me a job at the local TV station doing editing work, film editing and then video editing. Eventually started working in front of the camera, and then out of that came a 10-year career in broadcasting and ended up in Baltimore, Maryland. I was in Baltimore, and some gal that was a friend of mine called me from New York and said, hey, I'm at an art gallery opening here in New York. They're playing your music. I said, what? That can't be. Oh, yeah, it's a CD here. I said, no, we never made a CD. Oh, yeah, it says Silver Apples. And so I got curious, went to the other music record store, and it's called Other Music in New York, and there was just a whole section on Silver Apples, stuff that I had never seen. People were bootlegging it, copying it, covering it, tributing it in every form, CD, vinyl, tapes, and I had no idea. I was totally astonished that anybody would pay any attention to the dribble that Danny and I created. I thought we were total failures. I thought that it just never would go anywhere. But here it was, and the DJs were sampling this stuff all over the place, and there were T-shirts in Brooklyn that said, there's a line in Gypsy Love that says pain hurts, and people were wearing T-shirts that say pain hurts because they would play that over and over and over again during the DJ sampling. I signed all this stuff that the record owners were throwing in front of me, all these bootlegs and illegitimacies of one kind or another. I was signing it like crazy. I had no idea I shouldn't do that. So I just you know, I relished in it. And then finally somebody said, if you want to play, you can come play. The guys at the knitting factory said, come play. And I said, uh-oh, now, I don't even have any gear. What am I going to do? So I started putting together, I got some musicians who were familiar with Silver Apples who could help me go around and find some oscillators, put it all together, find a drummer. And I eventually put together a show at the Knitting Factory, and it's been nonstop ever since.
That's actually amazing. Do you feel that if earlier you would have been on a different record company and with a different management team or in a different situation, the group would have taken off anyway?
I think so, yeah. I think that it would have been an easier trip for me, but I think that eventually people would have come around to the idea that you can really have party and good fun without guitars. That with the way Dammy was drumming and the way I was playing and just the freedom that we were trying to push out and the sort of happy-go-lucky, wackadoo attitude, I don't see how that could have missed. The record label and their lawsuit people, their legal team, they didn't have any sense of humor. That second record sunk us and sunk the record label, too, turns out.
And you didn't release the third one that you'd recorded.
We didn't then. It's since been released. Yeah. I do a lot of the material from the third record, The Garden, but that wasn't released until the 90s. We found some old tapes in Danny's attic and put them together, cleaned them up, put them out on vinyl.
And you go all over the world with this. You go to Australia, all over Europe.
Oh, yeah, Japan, China.
Yeah. Is Europe where you ran into Larry?
Yes. I did a show about, I don't know, 5 years ago in London, and Larry was not with the Stooges at the time. He was with Jesse Evans, who was an amazing cabaret kind of performer. And she and Toby were playing on the same stage as me that night. And so we were backstage munching on a pizza and talking about stuff and discovered that we were both from Knoxville. And we just thought that was funny as hell. Neither one of us had ever met anybody from Knoxville over there before. And so that kind of stuck. You know, you don't, that kind of thing doesn't go away. Then last year, we bumped into each other backstage again in Oslo, Norway. He said, why don't we do something? Why don't we play some music together? I love your stuff. Let's play some music. And so I said, you put something together and I'm there. So that's it. He called Ashley Capps and here we are.
And here you are in Knoxville, Tennessee, only about 4 miles away from your old home address.
Yeah.
What's the plan or the strategy for putting something together with Larry, who you've, I guess, never really played with until this week?
The Joy of Music School has offered us a studio space to rehearse in. We've already done one session. As soon as we leave here today, we're going to do another session tomorrow, and probably something on Sunday before we break down. I don't know. And then we will be fairly well rehearsed. It's amazingly easy, actually. We've played the entire set roughly, but we played it. You know, we got through it. Here's how we started. Here's how we ended. Here's what happens in the middle. And it's going to work. If we had to do it today, we'd do it. We'd feel the roughness of it, but I don't think an audience would. I think it's going to be easy. His drumming is very clean and precise, and my stuff is stuff that I've been doing for 10 years or more, and I've kind of got it down as a craft. And so his craft is honed, and my craft is honed, and we're both kind of in the same groove. We speak the same language musically, and it just fell together. It's kind of nice.
Now that you've been back in Knoxville, you've only been back really literally probably a day or so.
Yeah.
Is there anything you recognize or anything you feel being back here? And had you been here in the interim at all?
Off and on, here and there, passing through, stopping to see a cousin, this kind of thing. Played a little gig about, maybe 6-8 years ago at a bar. But I think the town has totally changed. We were out in North Hills, or the North Hills area, out Broadway, to do a TV show. And I recognized some of the places. Not so much the buildings, but some of the landscape I recognized from driving down Broadway from the north. I recognize some things, but basically it's a new city to me.
Our guest again on this evening's Flipside, Simeon from the Silver Apples. He played in Knoxville at the Big Ears Festival with drummer Larry Mullins, another Knoxville native. Simeon, it was a real treat to have you down here in the studio at WUOT. Thanks for coming by.
Cheers.
Spells of rose, magic fingers through my hair.